Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening. I'm Chris Taylor, Deputy Editor of the digital and social media website Mashable. I'm a veteran technology journalist for some 15 years, and I'm your moderator for tonight's Inforum event with Clay Shirky. Clay comes to us from New York University, where he has not one but two titles, Associate Professor at the Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute and Assistant Arts Professor at the Interactive Telecommunications Program. Now, that's a bit of a mouthful, and one of the things Clay is known for is explaining rather complex concepts clearly. So let me quote from the first line of his website, which simply says, "I study the effects of the Internet on society." He's the author of Here Comes Everybody, which covered the concept of crowdsourcing long before most of us knew what that was. More recently, he wrote Cognitive Surplus, which explained, among other things, why people would want to spend their time editing Wikipedia when they could be watching television. Tonight, we're going to have a discussion about other examples of these kinds of behaviors in the news right now, and Clay will explain to us how the Internet runs on love. So, ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm, informed welcome to Mr. Clay Shirky. Thank you. Thank you. Clay, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So, the Internet runs on love. A wonderful concept, and I have to say, when I first thought it, I thought, boy, you've come to the right town to talk about the Internet.
And the summer of love every summer from 1967 to now, yeah.
And especially right now, there's group love breaking out.
Right.
So what does it mean?
You know, it's really an observation that there are all kinds of motivations that people have that are neither personal nor financial. And that those motivations have typically expressed themselves in private or at least away from public visibility, right? We do things with our friends, we do things with our families, we do things in these kind of ad hoc groups. And I certainly grew up in a world where you could do little things for love, right? You could have a birthday party, you could get together and make a potluck supper and so forth. But big things took money. Right. If you wanted to do something like make an encyclopedia or an operating system, it took a big organization. It took people who had been hired and given roles and were paid and all of that. And what we started to see, what we've really seen as the Internet's grown up, but especially as it broke out into the public in the 90s, we've seen bigger and bigger projects being taken on based on people's personal motivations, not on having a job, not on having a boss, not on being given a list of tasks you have to complete today, but people diving into projects because they care about them or because they're interested in them. And, you know, one of the really big surprises about the Internet, I think, for many people is the idea that when you do things at a very large scale, they're different. It's not just the small thing inflated, right? When you can get a huge group of people looking in on a shared reference work like Wikipedia, you can create the kinds of effects that there's no analogy for in small scale. And that's consistently been the big surprise, is that people's generous and personal motivations in very large aggregates turn out to create the kinds of effects that we didn't see in the 20th century.
Wikipedia remains, I think, the most interesting example.
Absolutely. I mean, it's right.
When you were first writing about it, it was still a little controversial.
Right.
It still is in sort of the journalism realm in terms of fact-checking. But
right.
I think more and more people are accepting that it is a legitimate source of information.
Right. Have you
seen that in your own experience, that it just is gaining more and more credence?
Yeah, and very often what happens is that these arguments don't get settled. They just stop.
Yeah.
Right? It's not like people have finally come to some sort of agreement. The people who disliked or distrusted Wikipedia have done one of two things. They've either sort of acquiesced to its status as the world's English language reference book, or they have themselves just dropped their objections without even really solving them. You just see people then turning, you know, well, when was the Crimean War? How else would you answer a question like that except looking it up on Wikipedia? Or if you go to Google, Google sends you to Wikipedia. So it just adds a click in between, but you get the same result. And so the argument didn't get settled so much as society just adopted it. And part of the reason it adopted it, I think, is that Wikipedia started not just to do the old reference functions well, but also to take on new kinds of characteristics, new kinds of problem solving that society needed. The first time I saw their ability to do real-time assembly of important information was in the aftermath of the tsunami, the Indian Ocean mm-hmm. tsunami in the middle of last decade. There was a tsunami page created almost instantly, and then a huge number of updates were being continually integrated over the next 24 hours. We're all used to that now, right? Mm-hmm. When the Gezi Park thing blows up in Turkey, when the vinegar protests start in Brazil, when the bombs went off in at the Boston Marathon, the Wikipedia page is created within minutes, and everyone knows to go there. Mm. I think a lot of those functions, where it's not even analogous to anything, say, Encyclopedia Britannica could have imagined doing, helped people adopt Wikipedia as a reference work. Where, you know, if you trust it to tell you about the Boston bombings, mm-hmm. then why not trust it for these other things as well?
So it seemed like we moved on pretty quickly from, I mean, the Wikipedia phase of the internet is still ongoing, but then...
But the phase where people were arguing about it has largely stopped, yeah.
But then now there's this social layer that comes on top of it. You move from a collaborative encyclopedia to a collaborative news environment.
Right.
Which brings us to Reddit.
Right.
And I'm glad
you... Alas. Yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned the Boston bombings, because, of course, that was Reddit's chance to shine in a lot of ways.
And not their finest hour.
And not their finest hour. For anyone that doesn't know, what happened was Reddit set to work looking at all of these pictures from security cameras around the area where the bombings took place, misidentified a number of suspects, and sort of became a vigilante, an online vigilante service.
That's absolutely fair. And the two catastrophic mistakes, they picked a pair of people whose photos were then picked up in other media outlets. Mm. So they didn't just do the damage on Reddit. They were the upstream source of further besmirching of these reputations of these utterly blameless young men. And the other thing they did was they linked up with a kid who had left Brown University, had just literally walked out of his dorm room, leaving no trace. And they identified him as being one of the possible bombers. Well, it turned out, in fact, that he sadly killed himself, and he killed himself well in advance of the bombings. But Reddit was just as wrong as they could be. And I shouldn't say Reddit as a whole. The people doing the crowdsourced detective work of looking through those photos were just as wrong as they could
be. To the point where the FBI actually made a statement about, don't believe what you read online.
Right. I have a student who was an NYU journalism student, went on to work for the Post, and got mail from him saying basically how heartrending it was to see the New York Post follow this mistake and then put this photo on the cover. And because they were publishing in internet time but with print mentality, they didn't take it down when they knew they were wrong. Mm. Because print, you're used to, well, it's out there, what are we going to do? We'll run a correction the next day. And seeing the compounded error of that kind of that bit of journalism culture was really painful. The alarming thing about Reddit, on top of the mistake itself, was that it's very difficult in a system like Reddit to learn from your mistakes. Hmm. So one of the big advantages of Wikipedia over Reddit, and this will sound crazy, but it's true, one of the big advantages of Wikipedia over Reddit is that Wikipedia has a bureaucracy.
Right.
And we have all been conditioned to think that bureaucracies are universally bad and you have to dismantle them. But when Wikipedia learned that the pernicious harm from Wikipedia was going to come from biographies of living persons, everything else was up for grabs. You could let people argue, but you had to be especially careful when people were making statements about currently living people. They put in place a number of characteristics around those particular articles that make them more susceptible to administrator oversight and locking and various other controls. The alarming thing about Reddit is not only did they make that mistake, that's a mistake we've understood for 10 years. Mm. Jane McGonigal, the game designer and theorist, has an amazing paper on this group called the Cloud Makers, who were playing a game that was tied to the Steven Spielberg AI movie. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the first places where the work of art made on the web by the marketing department was better than the movie itself. The movie was not great, but there was this game called The Beast that was phenomenally complicated, and they said, all right, well, we've made about 3 months worth of, you know, online gameplay for these players, and they can figure it out together. And then, you know, 90 days from now, we'll have to start updating it. This group called Cloud Makers formed. They created their own conversational space. They solved every extant problem in that game in the first 24 hours. And so suddenly the game designers were racing. They started to realize what collective intelligence could do. That group stayed together over that summer of 2001, and in September of that year, the 9/11 attacks happened. And in that group, they said, this is a new puzzle. We can solve this puzzle too. And for about 48 hours, everyone in that group was excited about solving the 9/11 puzzle. And then you could see this kind of really adult sense of their own limits kick in. Mm-hmm. And they said, no, we can't do anything of the sort. What were we even thinking? We were playing a game before that had a structured design. We may be able to do some things about sifting through data, but we can't. 9/11 isn't a puzzle. It's a real-world event. It doesn't have those characteristics. And so we've already seen, a decade ago, people face the mistake Reddit made and then back off of it. And the fact that there's no place to vest that memory is, I think, really alarming. Reddit, I think, now has the antibodies so that the next time this happens, people will say not just this is something to worry about, but this is something to worry about on Reddit.
Right. There's an institutional memory.
But if every time we get a new large-scale collection of people, of which many, many more are coming, we have to relearn all these lessons, it's going to be a long decade. And so that's the part that worries me.
So there is this sort of, I mean, it's kind of the internet runs on love, but it might be mafia love, right?
Right. Well, no, it's
vigilante instinct.
Right. It's
when something goes wrong.
The easiest thing in the world to do is to trigger in-group sensibilities, right? We are up the road from the Stanford Prison Experiment where simply naming people and giving them utterly arbitrary identities causes in-group and hierarchical dynamics to happen. And there's a wonderful, actually not a wonderful book, it's a terribly written, very important book, which is something that can only exist in nonfiction. Wilfred Bion, a psychologist, a group psychologist, spent a lot of time observing these groups that he was working with. And one of the things he observed is, since it's always very pleasurable to align yourself with your fellow group members against an external enemy, groups that don't have external enemies will tend to adopt paranoids as their leaders because they are very good at identifying threats that don't exist, which causes the group to cohere. So the internet runs on love, which is, you know, as a gloss, you know, essentially hides a lot of the complexity of group dynamics. One of the downsides is that love is not always universal. Mm. It is often love for the fellow members of your group, and it can be quite specifically targeted against other kinds of targets. Right? We like it when it's anonymous taking on Scientology, or some of us like it when it's anonymous taking on Scientology. But you can take those same dynamics and apply them to other groups, right? Certainly the rise of misogyny against Anita Sarkeesian doing I've only ever seen her name written, but the woman who does the video pieces about basically the representation of women in video games, the amount of hatred directed at her was a product of these same dynamics. So, you know, that now becomes the cultural challenge we have to face, which is groups are more powerful than they used to be, full stop, and now we're sorting out which groups that, as a society, we would, you know, where do we want to heighten their work and where do we want to try and put a cap on it.
I think we see this on the individual level a lot on Facebook, and I think we've all experienced that sense of passion,
right,
which I think is best summed up by the XKCD cartoon.
Someone
on the internet is wrong.
Yes.
I must correct them. And we see these lengthy debates, right, break out in the, right, comments section, right, of a Facebook post.
Yep.
You mentioned that you've also seen it on the site 4chan, which,
yes,
perhaps we should explain what 4chan,
yeah,
is for,
I mean,
those not familiar.
Yeah, so 4chan is an American copy of a Japanese site that was called 2CH. Mm-hmm. And it's two main innovations relative to any other group bulletin board system you've ever seen or used are: it is anonymous by default. You have potentially an identity on the site, but it's connected to almost nothing and is completely disposable. And there are no archives. So everything, things aren't stored, they can't be looked up the next day, there is no search function. And so you get this really crazy flow of conversation that can be, as it is on 4chan, and especially on the most famous board on 4chan called B, which the denizens of whom often call themselves B-tards, you get all kinds of crazy stuff. It's where lolcats came from, it's where rickrolling came from, it's this weird effusion of essentially internet culture. It's also the source of tremendous racism, misogyny, homophobia. But the thing that has really, I find remarkable about 4chan recently, as an academic, I'm required to hang out on 4chan. So, I've invented a job for myself where any other description of my time would be, that guy is wasting a lot of time on the internet. But the remarkable thing on 4chan recently, there have been a number of threads that would ordinarily devolve into the pure racism, misogyny, what have you, a group of unfettered, anonymous, largely white teenage boys would fall into in this country. But the audience, the participant base there, has expanded to be more diverse, and you start to see real arguments break out. There are real conversations about gay marriage, there are real conversations about feminism, there are real conversations about racism, and the language is foul and shouty, but because everyone's anonymous, no one can be targeted and no one can be shouted down in any... You can decide this is ridiculous and I'm logging out, but you can't... And you can't even get the last word in, which is, the essential part of the Facebook thing. Because there's no archive, and you never know when your thread is just going to go 404, there's not even a way to just dominate the conversation through pure input, as people often do. And the extraordinary thing about these conversations, and I've been logging them over the last several months to do something in the future with them, I'm not quite sure what, but even before I figure out what I want to write about them, just the extraordinary thing about them is they are often better, more complicated conversations about those same issues than you would see in the comments section of any newspaper, where when the concern is civility, what you get is people basically capping the shouting to the lowest acceptable level before they get their comment deleted. And you also get people, because their names are attached, you get no one changing their mind, right? Because once someone's committed their name to a particular opinion, they're more concerned with defending continuity than with rethinking the issues. And, anonymity gets a bad name, in many cases deservedly so, but in the case of 4chan, there are these conversations that are some of the most civically rich conversations I've ever seen, in the sense of people who really disagree with one another, unable to get the upper hand in any way other than arguing. And it's fascinating to see.
So Congress should move to 4chan?
Congress should move to GitHub. But, this is, I think, one of the really big themes going on right now. My current working theory. I gave a talk about this time last year. My current working theory is that media changes society when it changes the way people argue. Right, that when we got the commercial printing press, that one of the first things we got was erotic novels. Right, it did not take people long after they had a commercial interest in selling books before they said, "Hey, you know what? I bet people would pay for right." That so by the late 1490s, right, Gutenberg invents the thing in 1450. By the late 1490s, Venice, right, giving it a reputation the Italians have enjoyed ever since, starts producing these erotic novels. It takes another 150 years for people to even think of the scientific journal, right? So the stuff that we venerate the press for now didn't come as a side effect of getting the printing press. It came as a result of people saying, hey, we could have a different kind of argument about science if we all published our results and then we all argued with each other about what we'd published. And so peer review was this social overlay that wouldn't have been possible without the printing press, but the printing press didn't create peer review. So when you look at GitHub now, right, which is where the programmers are arguing about the software they're writing, and you look at Congress, and you think Congress should be arguing, people arguing about the law should be arguing with each other about the law more like programmers are arguing with each other about source code. Mm. Because you can have all of these characteristics where I can show you what I mean, right? You say you want to program things one way, I want to program things another way. Each of us can completely, what's called forking, you get your copy, I get my copy, we go and look at it after the fact. Legal arguments are so rarely about what the law would look like or do, and yet that, not the congressional debate in advance, that is what the output of Congress is. Mm-hmm. And it's treated as kind of effluvia when, in fact, that's the living document. In fact, I just had coffee with someone who is working with the House, which is the more technically advanced of the two chambers in the U.S., to try and update the way they manage the law, precisely because we have this incredibly archaic system in which everything is, this law amends that law, which amends that law, and it never all gets concatenated in one place. So you know, much as Congress on 4chan is an amusing thought, I think Congress should really be on GitHub, and I hope that they get there, because it would be a big improvement over what we've got today.
Well, speaking of social media layered on top of politics, we had an interesting example just yesterday in Texas, Representative Wendy Davis.
Oh, and another one is coming on July 1st, as it turns out. Rick Perry's just called the special session.
Yes.
Another special session.
So talk us through exactly what happened there and why it's interesting.
There was a bill before a special session of the Texas legislature, which was an omnibus bill which had several controls or restrictions on abortion. And would have had as its side effect capping abortion at 20 weeks across the state and closing, I believe, all but five of the state's 40 or so abortion clinics, including most of the ones operating in rural areas. So it would have been nothing less than catastrophic for the reproductive rights of women in Texas. A woman named Wendy Davis, a congressperson and a member of the legislature in Texas, filibustered, and she filibustered the old-fashioned way. She stood for 12 hours and change. She could not lean on anything. She couldn't go to the bathroom. It was an amazing performance. In fact, the best, I forget who said this on Twitter, but someone said about 8 hours in to her performance, someone said, now the legislators understand what mansplaining feels like. So she did this whole thing, right? She did half a day and a bit of talking. And then at the very end, three really important things happen. There's a three strikes rule for filibusters in Texas, where if you make three procedural mistakes, your filibuster is considered to be over. At one point, she had someone help her come up and adjust her back brace. And that was considered an impermissible political move. It tells you what politics is like in Texas. And on two other occasions, she discussed aspects of female reproductive health that were not, to the eye of the chair, the ear of the chair, relevant to the bill. So they had three strikes, and they were gonna truncate the filibuster and have a vote. And at that point, the watching gallery erupted because this was clearly a procedural ploy. But people were also glued to YouTube And they were glued to YouTube because CNN was running. I mean, I don't know if you're following the blueberry muffin story, but CNN decided that blueberry muffins were really the thing that the nation needed to be hearing about right then. They've gotten out of the news business entirely, which is sort of distressing, given that it's literally their middle name, but not any longer. So YouTube is now our cable news channel.
And it was streaming the whole thing live.
And streaming the whole thing live. People are watching. So there is this group that's present there. There is this group that's present online. They're all watching the same thing. They're watching each other watch it. The group shouting down the chair keeps the clock going past midnight. But then they post the vote, and it says, you know, the vote took place after midnight, victory for the filibuster, because the session has technically ended at midnight on that day. Then the site goes down, and then it comes back up with the timestamps changed, so it makes it look as if the vote was conducted on the day before. The people in the chamber couldn't see that change. The people online could. So it wasn't just that you needed people in the room observing the politicians work. And it wasn't just that you needed people online watching the politicians work. You needed the people in the room, and you needed the people online, and you needed them to be talking to each other. Mm. And that, I mean, it's not just the end of digital dualism, right? Real world and internet. It's really this new phase of hybridization where you had to have both people physically manifesting themselves in the space, and you had to have the virtual participation in the political conversation. We saw that happen a little bit in the Occupy movement. People were, you know, were down here. People were in Zuccotti Park in New York. But there was also the We Are the 99% Tumblr. So there was a physical occupation of the spaces. Then there was this virtual this virtual conversation that was nation and later worldwide. But the thing in Texas took that and it amped it up because it was about the procedure of democratic politics. Mm. And that hybridization, we're seeing a little bit with the vinegar protests in Brazil. We're seeing it a lot with Gezi Park in Turkey, where essentially citizen media is media full stop. Mm. CNN, again, ran penguins. They ran a three-part documentary on the life cycle of penguins while the Turkish police were hitting their own people with tear gas in the main square of the capital city, or of the largest city. So that hybridization now of real-world groups, virtual groups that are not only watching at the same time but watching each other watch, that's interesting and new. And it's not like anybody designed it. It was just the side effect of the other tools plus the political interest.
So social media is the new megaphone.
Well, yeah, it's the new megaphone, but, you know, I mean, here's the real problem, and this is the 20-year problem. Every time we reach for a metaphor like that, what we get is, yeah, I've got a way to explain this in a soundbite. Although Aaron says we're supposed to go beyond the soundbite, so now maybe we'll do that. But what you lose is everything that's strange about social media because it's not like a megaphone. Mm-hmm. And that, what happened in Texas wasn't just like a megaphone. It wasn't just you're shouting and I'm shouting, and as long as we both have megaphones, we're even. It was collaborative. Megaphones, whatever else they are not good tools for collaboration. And it's the ad hoc collaborative piece that is really the strange new effect. And it's the thing that the politicians in many cases are having the hardest time dealing with. You know, clearly around the Occupy movement, people are like, well, you know, in New York at least, not in San Francisco, but in New York, everybody's like, well, it's just going to get cold and they'll leave. And what they didn't understand is there were enough people looking in to raise money or bring in resources or supplies, so that as long as there were people willing to sleep on the ground, there were people willing to run supply chains into that park. And they finally realized this is not ever going to go away by itself. Mm. And that's not a megaphone-like. It's a political effect, but it's not a megaphone-like effect.
So it's a backup. It's a cavalry-like effect.
In some ways, yeah, you can, and you can't count on it, which is to say the ad hoc nature of it makes it not the same as, you know, Greenpeace or an organization that you can count on being there next year. It's got its pluses and minuses. One of the big minuses is, you can't count on getting the hive mind interested in any given topic that they should be interested in, however that's calculated. But the flip side is that when people have decided to commit, it's a really remarkable force, made doubly so by the fact that very little of the existing political apparatus knows how to respond.
Mm. But they know it when they see numbers.
But right.
Yes. So switching gears slightly, we just had the DOMA decision
yep.
in the Supreme Court yesterday. And
yes, we did.
There have been many interesting debates on Facebook,
yep.
within the comments of Facebook.
Yep.
And I believe you have some interesting statistics on Facebook and how it may
yeah.
have sort of normalized gay marriage.
Right. So there's an interesting... A piece that was just published that says 70% of Americans on Facebook have at least one person in their network who publicly identifies as gay, right? And if you just do it numerically, that doesn't seem like such a big deal, right? You're working on the 1 in 10 calculation. Anybody who's got 11 friends is probably, you know, someone in there. But it's the fact that it's publicly identified and visible, not just... Right, that my sexual identity is visible not just to you, but visible to everybody who knows both of us, meaning that everybody also knows that you know.
Hmm.
So there's this amazing book called, quite modestly, Why Humans Cooperate, by the Henricks, a pair of sociological researchers, who go through the phases of how human beings keep each other behaving according to communal norms. And the first phase is you punish the people who defect from communal norms, right? If you do something in my community you're not supposed to be doing, we punish you. The second phase is that you punish the non-punishers, right? Meaning if I see you not intervening, I go and punish you. And the third phase is you punish the people who are not punishing the non-punishers, meaning if someone sees me slacking off on you, slacking off on her, I get punished. That only works in small towns, right? The bigger the city, the fewer of those layers you can bring to bear until you essentially have a world in which the only people who can really punish defections are it's a formal legal system, not the strong social norms. So what Facebook has done and what the internet has done for many people is it's essentially introduced us to urban density of information and observation. Because if people can see you knowing me and you know something about me that they don't like, on Facebook they have very few mechanisms to force us to either shut up about it or to go away. So the visibility of the visibility of people's public declarations of their sexuality is a generic part of the story of the legalization of gay marriage. But I think much more important is the ability to actually see the individuals who you know who are gay and the fact that your connection with them is now a matter of public record.
And you get to see their stories on a day-to-day basis.
Right. And there was a very interesting thing. It was maybe Justice Powell who said about the Bowers v. Hardwick case, which is just a travesty of, it was the 1986 case which said essentially Georgia can keep anti-sodomy laws on the books. And they broke in on two guys and then were able to arrest them. It wasn't like they were out in the public square. And that was, you know, that was deemed to be constitutionally valid. One of the things Powell said is, I don't know anyone who's gay. And one of his own clerks in that term was gay. But because Powell didn't know it in any kind of public way, he didn't factor it into his thinking. So there is a current right now of essentially aristocratic thought which says all attempts at public participation by naive or uncommitted actors amounts to nothing more than clicktivism and makes no difference whatsoever. And what you see when you see things like the gay marriage case are that there are places where very simple public acts. It may seem like flipping the sexuality bit on a given social media profile is no big deal. But in aggregate, it robs people of the ability to say, there's only a small number of people involved. They live in, you know, weird enclaves like your city and my city, et cetera, et cetera. And relative to this aristocratic strain of thought, there was an image going around of John Roberts leaning over the Supreme Court bench saying, you know, before we decide this case, have enough people changed their Facebook profile yet? And it seems ridiculous on its face to say that, right? The Supreme Court is somehow isolated from American public opinion. Except we know perfectly well from studies of Supreme Court behavior that they are not at all isolated from American public opinion, and that they factor that both formally and informally into their decisions. And that the collectivism critique, which assumes that only elite committed actors change politics, ignores the ways in which the background beliefs, assumptions, commitments of the American people can now be manifest in ways that don't require, you know, essentially voting or large media companies to aggregate those preferences first. They can just emerge. Mm. And that's I think where the you know, really Facebook, but every place that people are publicly manifesting aspects of life, that's where it starts to affect American politics.
So in terms of money coming into the equation, when people start to turn from just clicking on something to donating to something.
Right.
We have, since you wrote the book, we've had the rise of Kickstarter.
Yep.
And I'm kind of curious here in the audience, how many of you guys have donated to a Kickstarter campaign of any sort?
Aha.
Wow.
Substantially all.
That's right. Quite a lot. At least,
how many
at least 50%.
How many of you have either started one or actively helped promote one?
That's quite a few.
Yeah, quite a few. Yeah. Interesting.
So Kickstarter is activism in action.
Right.
But in the corporate sphere.
Well, so it's in the corporate sphere. So this is one of the hardest problems of talking about politics or even public action, which is it's all the corporate sphere online, right? Mm-hmm. We don't have public speech. We have commercial speech that tolerates political themes. Facebook is a publicly held company that exists to make money, as is Google, as is Yahoo, as is Twitter is not publicly held yet, but as Twitter is a commercial firm. They tolerate public speech. To my eye, Twitter does the best job of defending that as part of their explicit goal. But we're wrestling with a world where the environments in which we can talk to each other the way members of a democratic public talk to each other are all commercially owned. And so we have this weird set of assumptions we bring about freedom of speech that assumes that something like the First Amendment applies to public environments, but it only applies to public environments in as much as they're made or kept public by the government. So there's a fascinating case. There's a guy, Ken Hoinsky. I've only read his name. I haven't heard it pronounced, so I think that's the right pronunciation. On Kickstarter, either earlier this week or late last week, he was kickstarting a book for pickup artists, right? It was basically how to pick up women. And someone took sections from this book and quoted it, which created this backlash, right? It was called in various places a manual for rape and so on. And so then Kickstarter took it down, and they instituted a ban against seduction manuals or anything like on the grounds that they were inherently misogynist. At which point a group of feminists said, we are going to put up a Kickstarter campaign which is a guide to seduction to help women take more control of their romantic lives. And Kickstarter then refused to, and I think it was either yesterday or just this morning, Kickstarter also refused to post that project, but weirdly they pointed this group of feminist authors to the language in the guidelines drafted only a couple of days ago that said this is inherently misogynist, even though it was the feminist doing it. Right, so you get this, like, it's Kickstarter's problem is that what they really wanted to say is that Hoinsky's kind of a dick and we don't like that book and so we pulled it. Right, and they're in their commercial rights to do that. But increasingly, they have to behave as if everything is a kind of, you know, value-neutral application of this existing set of codicils and regulations that we've developed. And it means that it's really unclear what you can and can't do with these services. Kickstarter is a classic example of difference in degree becoming difference in kind, right? You've always been able to, you know, raise money from friends and family, pass the plate in the, you know, in the church or the temple or the mosque or whatever, you know, get some group of people who know each other to donate. What Kickstarter does is it lets you do it at very large scale, very high speed, very low cost in a distributed way, right? So you can't actually extrapolate from a small group of friends kicking in to what you're able to do on Kickstarter. What it means is that Kickstarter has no comfortable metaphor. They don't have this is a megaphone thing. Mm. They can't say, oh, we're just like X, because there's never been anything like what they're able to do. And what they're able to do goes up by an order of magnitude every year. So one of our students at ITP and at NYU, after he graduated, he and his business partners said, hey, let's see if we can get $10,000 to make this little tripod for the iPhone that helps you take, you know, stabilize it for pictures. They called it the Glyph. Tried to raise $10,000. And they raised $10,000. And then 20. And then 40. And then 80. And it topped out at about $140,000. So 14x what they'd originally gone for. And instead of launching a product, they launched a company. They founded Studio Neat based on this project. And then everybody said, oh, this is great. This is the new investment platform. At which point the SEC comes in and says, oh, no, it's not, because you can't give people stock if they give you money if you're not. And so every year, Kickstarter is going to run into these things where it turns out that the way we used to keep certain things from happening wasn't by design or regulatory fiat or any of the rest of it. It's just pure inconvenience. You couldn't just say, hey, I got a little idea for a tripod, and now I've raised enough money to found a company. And you couldn't say, here's my little pickup artist book, and can you give me tens of thousands of dollars? And that puts Kickstarter in this weird place, analogous to what I was saying earlier about Wikipedia and the buildup of bureaucracy. Kickstarter is also building up a bureaucratic shell around what you can and can't do, because the one thing they cannot afford to do with whatever, there are 4 or 5 dozen people there, they can't afford to answer every question ad hoc. And so they're developing policy and they're developing regulatory frameworks for answering these questions. But it means saying to feminists, your work is inherently misogynist, which makes no sense on its face, but at least saves them from having to answer every question as it comes up.
Certainly they're going through some teething troubles. I actually wanted to go back to the audience. We had about 50% of people here who had contributed to a Kickstarter. How many of you folks feel like you've been ripped off, or you didn't receive what you were supposed to receive? Anyone? No.
Nice, clean. Well, not a
or not admitting.
So one of the interesting things about Kickstarter is they insist simultaneously on there is a transaction, right? I give you $1,000, you give me a T-shirt, we call it even, right? Clearly, I'm making a donation to your cause, but the T-shirt sort of satisfies them that there's something transactional. But then they say, oh, we are not a store, right? We're a place where you transact and you give people money and they give you something, but we're not a store, because they also want to be a philanthropy. And so, again, we don't have either the mental or legal models for that thing they're trying to do. And it's partly because when they started, really, it was people, you know, we want to release a 10-inch vinyl EP for our, you know, our little goatee-bearing band in Bushwick, and, you know, give us some money. And that worked out fine, but once it's become, you know, I mean, basically, we're in a power law distribution part of Kickstarter's development now, where the largest Kickstarter project in any given year is probably going to be twice as large as the previous year, and it's probably going to be twice as large as the previous largest thing that had ever happened. So it's the top end is just going to blow off anything anybody's seen from these kinds of platforms. 90% of the projects are still going to be, I want to do a little book of poetry, I'm trying to get a movie going, I got, you know, whatever. But the power law distribution is what underlines the 80-20 rule, the stuff that gets the most attention, the most money is all going to be completely out of people's own experience of doing kind of small projects. So Kickstarter's worry, I think, is not that people will get ripped off. They want to stop that from happening. But
even when it happens, it's going to be fairly marginal. I think, as we saw from having a room of most, you know, most people in the room have participated, no one has felt ripped off. Kickstarter's real problem is, how can they keep the good feeling of really anybody with a, you know, with a dream and a few friends to seed it with can use this platform to at least try to bootstrap it, with the idea that someone's raising $10 million to start a video game or make a movie. As long as that's the stuff that gets attention, which is disproportionately the stuff the press pays attention to, they're going to have a problem communicating the sort of, you know, smaller scale, more social stuff as they go.
So we're going to be getting to your questions in a little under 5 minutes. So if you have something to ask, you'll want to start formulating your question now and start lining up at the mics on either side of the room there. And as a reminder, we're looking for a single one-part question, no pitches, no stories, no multiple-part questions, please. And as a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Clubs in Forum. Connect your intellect, and tonight we're hosting Clay Shirky. And I'm Chris Taylor, Deputy Editor of Mashable. So we were talking about businesses and the new kind of business on Kickstarter and collaboration. Another new kind of business that they're trying to build down in Sunnyvale is Marissa Meyer's Yacht.
Oh, yes.
And she has, there was a little controversy recently where she asked her employees, or most of her employees, to come in and work from the office. And the focus was on, should that be okay? Should we be allowed to work at home? But it's, you think that it's more about collaboration in the workplace.
Well, yeah, I mean, so when Marissa did that, the conversation grew up, right, is this a good idea or a bad idea? Is it a good idea or a bad idea to make everybody come into Yahoo and work? And the answer to that question, I think, has to be not yes or no, but rather, it depends, right? If she was, you know, if Michael Tilson Thomas said, hey, you know what would be a great idea? It'd be a great idea if all the musicians in the San Francisco Philharmonic came to the same place to play their musical instruments together, right? That would not be a big story, right? You would not have big headlines of people second-guessing Tilson Thomas. If Linus Torvalds said, you know what, if you want to check in any new code to the Linux kernel, you have to move to Palo Alto, right? And we all have to go into a big room together, and you're not even allowed to look at the Linux code base unless you're in that room. Everybody would have thought he'd lost his mind, right? So exactly the same intuition as Marissa has. In one case, it's so obvious you would never question it. In the other case, it's so insane that you would never suggest it. So the question, I think, isn't, you know, working from home, good idea, bad idea, working at the office, good idea, bad idea. The question is, what kind of organization does Yahoo want to be, or what kind of organization does she want Yahoo to be? And when you ask the question that way, what you see is that we have a design problem we didn't used to have. If you wanted large, persistent collaboration, you had to have a building. Right, and the people had to go to the building to do that work. Right, you could have conference calls, but as anyone who's spent part of their life on conference calls knows, not a great place for getting work done. Whatever other, you know, other advantages that it might have. So she is one of the earliest CEOs to face this really significant design challenge, which is on the spectrum from the San Francisco Philharmonic to managing the Linux kernel. Where does my organization fall? And she's pretty clearly said, I want to be more like Michael Tilson Thomas than I want to be like Linus Torvalds. And, you know, it's way above my pay grade to second guess that choice. But what I was distressed about by that conversation was the assumption that there was a right answer, working from home good or bad, working at work good or bad, when the real question is, what are her goals for that organization, and does this heighten them or damage them? And this is one of the strange things that the internet does. You know, it's a general problem we now face, which is there were tons of decisions that used to be made for us by sheer inconvenience, right? If you wanted to have 60 people work together, you had to have a building, right? It wasn't like it was a big strategic choice the CEO had to take input on. There was no plan B. Now, there's ways to get 60 people to work together worldwide asynchronously. They don't even have to have met each other in many cases, and they can do amazing stuff. And also, there's ways to get 60 people to work together really intensively in a room collaborating. And I think we need to be thinking more when we see people like Marissa face choices like she faced. I think the conversation we need to be having isn't, isn't assuming that we can get to some right answer, but rather saying, what are the range of choices we're facing here, and how much more flexibility do we have in thinking about how people come together and get their work done than we used to have?
Certainly speaking from a journalistic standpoint, you know, I now work every day in a chat room with journalists from across the country. Much more collaborative, I think, and process-oriented than it would be if we were sitting in the same office.
Yeah, and interestingly, if you talk to Eli Pariser, who founded Upworthy, he was one of the people who was early in MoveOn and has now founded a group called Upworthy. They work highly distributed fashion. A lot of the work is done in a chat room. Paul Carr, who founded a company called NSFW Corp, the Not Safe for Work Corp, had a kind of get-together of his journalists in Vegas, where they are, and he said they got more work done in that weekend than they could have gotten done in the previous month. So even within the media realm, there are people operating at, and after this, Paul said, basically, if you want to work for us, one of the things we've learned is you pretty much have to move to Vegas. So even in the media world, we're starting to get this experience of you have to decide what kind of media company you want to be. There's no more obvious choices about collaboration. And it's a pain in the ass because then you have to go make all of these additional momentous decisions without a lot of history behind us. But they're real decisions we have to make. And you know, that's, I think, the lesson of the Yahoo story is this is a conceptual challenge that most CEOs in the history of the corporation have not faced. And she's one of the first people to face that choice and make it in a really forced way. I hope it's the right choice. Again, above my pay grade to guess. But much more importantly than just Yahoo is we all have to wrestle with that stuff
right
now.
So let's go to our first question.
Yes, sir.
Yes, I'm working on a project that has to do with right-wing religious and a military movement to take over the government in San Francisco. And Facebook has banned me, and Twitter loves me, and I wonder, and Google loves me too, and I'm wondering where else I might go to express myself further, and can I do it here at the Commonwealth Club also?
Well, I'll defer that second part of the question to Aaron. You know, my it's funny listening to you talk. My guess is that Facebook has banned you, Twitter loves you, and Google ignores you. I mean, Google.
No, Google loves me, and Facebook will not have me.
No, I'm sure that Facebook won't have you, but Google's approach to a lot of social stuff has been, in a way, the lightest regulatory approach possible, which is to
I'm all over Twitter. Like. Twitter just is fascinated by me.
So, you know, I would say on Twitter, keep pulling those threads. Basically, the people who are retweeting you, follow them, because you can always expand outwards from there.
Right.
But this gets back to the conversation we were having earlier. There is never going to be any consensus on what kind of speech is allowed and not on what platform. So it's really for any set of opinions, whether it's yours or anyone else's, it's going to be ad hoc about which platforms fit for you.
I see.
Can we have a next question, please?
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Great talk.
Thank you.
Good to see you in person. It's great that you mentioned science and the metaphor with the printing press and science and how our current media of revolution is intersecting with science. And I see, the open science movement, you know, there's some great progress, but also some big, severe disappointments.
Yeah.
I've been analyzing it, trying to see where I might be able to help lever it the most. And I've been thinking about your framework of promise, tools, bargain in analyzing it and what to develop. But I'm realizing that might be not enough. I'm just wondering if you can reflect on the open science movement and what can help it move forward. What are some of its hurdles that it needs to avoid?
Yeah.
And so, perhaps you could just explain the open science movement.
Right.
Just
so the open science movement is pretty much what it sounds like, right, which is the idea that if you make either data available for observation or if you make or if you ask for input from the sort of things that ordinary citizens would be able to participate in, you can generate scientific intuition without having to do it in the traditional ways. Probably the most famous example of that which Yochai Benkler put in Wealth of Networks, was the NASA Click Workers project, where they wanted to identify craters on the moon. And typically you would get a postdoc or a recently minted astronomy PhD to go through and do the incredibly boring work of this is an impact crater, that is just a cliff. And they would just draw circles on the map to identify these things. And what NASA found was that if you got three ordinary citizens, after a little bit of training, to identify craters, they would work as well as one PhD, which was initially alarming to the PhDs. But then they realized, right, maybe there are better things to be doing with my time than, you know, if all I've gotten to after doing a PhD is that I can work three times as fast as somebody off the street on a really menial task. Maybe there's something better I can be doing with my time. I'll tell you the parallel that I find most interesting with the open science movement, which is the open journalism movement. Mm-hmm. So much of the early conversation around citizen journalism assumed that each citizen, you know, everyone can be a little David Broder, right? The famous political journalist at the Washington Post. And then when this got tried, especially at Huffington Post and Off the Bus in 2008 and their Off the Bus project, it turned out that a surprisingly high percentage of the people who can be David Broder already are David Broder, right? It didn't really work because the individual citizens don't have the training to do the entire, you know, the entire chain that a journalist does. But what they did have the ability to do was wide-scale distributed reporting. So they could send one citizen to every one of, I think, 99 counties in Iowa to observe the Iowa caucuses, and then aggregate that stuff up in post-process. So the places where the open science movement is working well are the places where there is some connection between engagement of participation and the aggregate value of the input. If you look at NASA's Galaxy Zoo, for example, for identifying anything from galaxy types to finding supernova. If you look at Project NOAA for identifying organisms, organisms and habitats, folding at home, which is about protein folding, those are all places where you're not saying an individual citizen can behave like a scientist. What you're saying is individual citizens can produce in aggregate information that's far more valuable than the scientists can get either working on their own or only working with compute power. And one of the things we've learned about the open science movement, as with the open journalism movement, is that collaborative aggregates often replace or fill in the weaknesses in the existing chain much more than simply saying we're going to replace one, you know, we're just going to ask the amateurs to behave like professionals. And that I think is likely to survive as a general observation, which is that in places where amateurs are coming in to environments that were previously occupied only by professionals, it's much likelier to be participatory aggregates where the interesting work gets done than in kind of one-to-one replacement.
All right. Thank you. Let's have the next question.
So I really liked your observations about Texas and about how the web and YouTube in particular sort of like the magic that happened there was because the web dissolved the barrier between everybody around the country and
people who
were in the room.
Right.
And you talked about Turkey briefly. I was wondering if you were aware of it, you could talk about Standing Man and the difference between that and like the sympathetic physical protests with Turkey.
So one of the, you know, it's actually, what particular part of Standing Man is it you're interested in before I go
on? I'm interested in do you think Standing Man is it that exact, like, social media with a megaphone thing? Is it just another dumb lolcats-like internet meme, or is it, like, a new form of protest?
Right. So let me back up first. I don't make a distinction between dumb internet memes and politically important things. And, in fact, I think our desire to sort the world into silly and serious is one of the reasons that we often have a hard time thinking about this medium, because sometimes the silly things are serious, and in many cases, the silly things are where we hide the serious things. In particular, there's a really interesting group of ethnographers working on China. An Xiaomina and Tricia Wang in particular have done amazing work on the proliferation of memes in China around, you know, and An Xiaomina's phrase for it, in fact, is memes are the street art of the censored web, right? It's the stuff, that, it's the graffiti you see painted on the walls. So Standing Man in the Gezi, you know, in the Turkish uprising, is a way of breaking through the media blackout from you know in that environment. What makes the Gezi Park uprising so interesting? This is the park right by Taksim Square, which is one of the main squares in Istanbul, where a small environmental protest trying to convince the government not to cut down trees blew up into a multi-city protest, as Occupy did, as the Vinegar protests in Brazil did. But the crazy thing in Turkey is that although Turkey is a democracy, they have one of the most repressive media environments in the world, full stop, not just among democracies. They have more journalists in jail than China or Ethiopia, who are quite close to the bottom of the list. So in a way, the ability to make mediated political symbols that spread is in pretty direct relationship to how much the government is trying to keep a lid on these conversations. So having a visible symbol of protest or opposition in the United States, I was walking through Union Square and the LaRouches, the LaRouches, God bless them, the day after something happens, they've got a pamphlet explaining why now more than ever Lyndon LaRouche is the guy we need. And there's Obama with a little Nazi mustache, right? And no one bats an eye. No one blinks. In this environment, it's almost impossible to create a political symbol that has that kind of resonance. In Turkey, in China, really any evidence that there's independently circulating public opinion not controlled by the state has some of this, YouTube in Texas-like effect of it's not just the people turning out in Gezi Park physically. The presence of a kind of unified symbol on top of that is a much more direct affront to the government than something like that would be here.
So we've got time for one more question. I've been ignoring this side. So.
I think I was the first person on this side.
I'm so sorry. Please
all
go
right.
ahead.
But it's a good segue, though. I think in recent years we've seen some very good examples of working positive social change through social media, such as the start of the Arab Spring in Cairo, and a lot less effective ones. So my question for you is, what do you feel is the key to successfully rooting social change in the physical world so it doesn't fizzle out in the cyberverse?
Yeah. So this is again the clicktivism question. What's the right hybrid between physical presence and virtual presence? In some cases, purely virtual critiques can work. The famous facing down of the Million Moms boycott of JCPenney took place entirely online. In fact, the entire gay marriage debate has taken place largely symbolically because marriage is itself symbolic. There is no, when you get married, right after your marriage, you realize nothing really changed. we just agreed some stuff in public, and on we go.
It wasn't
like you've been hit by lightning. Spent a lot of money, right? Mm. But it wasn't like you've been hit by lightning. So in the cases where the social change is itself largely symbolic actions, and this relates a little bit to the previous question about Gezi, symbolic actions can make a big difference. The physical manifestations are much harder. And it turns out, and I don't know what this means, but it turns out that the design of the biggest square in the biggest city has a huge effect, right? Tiananmen Square in Beijing, Tahrir Square in Cairo, the Pearl Roundabout in Bahrain, Zuccotti Park, which is not the Central Park in New York City, but is the Central Park for Wall Street. That in a way, the question for manifesting physically is about where the manifestation is. It takes on itself additional symbolic weight. That having been said, most political change fizzles out, no matter whether it's coming from progressive or conservative forces. Right? Most politics is isometric, which is to say, There's no set of switches that if you put them in the right order, you automatically get the change you want. It's always going to be oppositional. And in fact, we may well lose, I say we, I'm not a Texan citizen, but we may well lose Texas on July 1st because they've called an additional separate session, which is to say what Perry is able to do, Rick Perry is able to do, may completely override what Wendy Davis was able to do. So even though the Texas action was an amazing tactical success, we shouldn't imagine that there is now or will ever be in Democratic politics any formula that guarantees that you can always move things in your direction or in the other direction. That having been said, you can concern yourself with ways of making symbolic, making even physical actions also carry symbolic weight. Let me put in a plug for a book called Beautiful Trouble, which is the first attempt to create a pattern language for this kind of protest. And it's just a series of tactics. It lists, I think, tactics, theories, actions, and people or groups. But one of the things that becomes really clear in all of these political questions, not just this one, is a big part of what's changed is just the range of what's possible now is much larger. There was a very interesting protest in India after the widely publicized and horrific rapes. There was a protest where men would show up wearing dresses, knowing precisely that this would bring out media attention. And in the invitation to this, they explicitly said, "Do not bring any signs. We don't want anyone carrying any placard." Because in a way, the press knows so well how to cover those stories that what the signs say almost doesn't matter anymore. And I think a big part of what people need to think through for politics is to assume not only that what worked last time might not work this time, but to ask, how can we do it differently this time so that it doesn't just look like another protest march of people walking around with signs, which we've all essentially learned to ignore. Whereas the set of protest techniques that say, we're going to imagine some new way to do this, it will have resonances with other things people have done. But the ability to take the wider range of tactics and press it into service now is, I think, the really big change.
So, Clay, there is one last question.
Oh, yes.
You've been very generous and expansive with your answers. This may be a challenge.
I have graduate school disease. I can't give a short answer to a simple question. But
this is an Inforum tradition, and it's what we do. We ask all of our speakers the following. What is your 60-second idea to change the world?
My 60-second idea to change the world is this business of Congress on GitHub. So I've kind of already blown it by doing it. By talking about that. But I think that media changes the world when it changes the way people argue. And I'm trying to make a list of new techniques the Internet enables for arguing. So two of the ones I know for sure, wikis, which is the idea that anybody can say anything, but there's a preserved history with rollback. That is a new idea. All praise to Ward Cunningham, who should have been inducted into the Internet Hall of Fame this year, but we'll get there someday. And the other is the idea of forking. Forking is new, right? The idea that I can have the entirety of the history of what's been done so far, and I can change it and update it, and you can do exactly the same thing without us having to hash it out in advance, and then we can compare afterwards and see where we differ. Those are two techniques that are not possible without a large distributed social cheap network. But once they're possible, you can have better arguments than you could before. And my idea to change the world is essentially to try and make a list of the places where we can argue better because of these new tools, and then ideally to try and find ways to get us to adopt those tools, because the history of, you know, the history of human society is that better arguing is one of the few things we can point to as an almost universal good.
I'm sure we can edit that down to 60 seconds.
Yeah, sorry.
Thank you, Clay. Let's give a big round of applause to Clay.
Thanks very much. Thank you. Thank you all for coming out.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. Thank you for sharing your musings with us. And now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.
Yes, the gavel.